And now, Forward with Falk. Join Scranton political observer Dave Falk and WFTE's Jake Rosen as they navigate their way through the political thicket. Dave, I think I told you that a couple of weeks ago, I happened to be, I happened to see Senator Casey, and he mentioned to me that he thought that this election would be the most expensive election in Pennsylvania history, maybe the most expensive election all in all in the country's history. He said that in the last election in Pennsylvania, $381 million was spent, and he expected it would be more than that in this election. So I want to turn to the question of money, because it seems to me that all of this is an outgrowth of the Citizens United decision, which says that rich people, corporations, can spend unlimited amounts, and they can do it in a hidden way. They don't have to reveal who they are, so people don't know, who, you know, when they say follow the money, you can't follow the money because it's hidden. But what we're seeing is some extraordinary, unimaginable expenditures. I mean, we have congressional races in which in 1 week people will dump $7, $8, $9 million in a congressional race, and that's just 1 week. We have donors who are donating $50 million at a clip, individual. And here in Pennsylvania, Jeffrey Yaz, the richest man in Pennsylvania, is one of those people who does it. So democracy becomes a commodity. This is what the meaning of the Citizens United ruling was, and now we see the actuality of it. Have you seen this reflected? Have you thought about this?
Oh, sure. And we've actually started talking about this a while ago. Remember when we talked about Art Pope down in North Carolina? Back in the 2010 election,
he was a piker. He did it for $2 million. He bought he bought the whole state legislature for $2 million.
You know, isn't there the story about back in 1960, Joe Kennedy dumping $1 million into his son's campaign for president and saying, you know, I'm willing to buy a victory but not a landslide.
Yes, that's right.
Wasn't that the line there?
That was the line. That's right.
You know, $1 million. Is
of course, like, $1 million then was worth, I don't know what the multiple is, was, you know.
It was real money. You know, the Everett Dirksen line, you know, $1 billion here, $1 billion there, and pretty soon you're talking real money. Right. Back then it was $1 million here and $1 million there. Yeah. That was the standard. And now that's no longer the standard. As you said, it's becoming, you know, plutocracy.
Becoming or become?
Well, you know, in some ways it always was. Don't forget the founders were among the richest people in the country. That was the unique thing about the American Revolution. It wasn't started by the masses. It was started by the gentry. The folks that met in Philadelphia were the big shots, so to speak. Right. John Hancock was a wealthy man. George Washington was a wealthy man. Jefferson was wealthy. Franklin was wealthy, although Franklin had more feel of the people, came from more humble backgrounds. But a lot of these were aristocrats.
Yes, that was a time when 80% of the wealth of the country was represented by slaves. And it was the people who owned slaves who formed the country.
Yeah. But getting back up to more current times, you're right about the Citizens United. The idea that money is speech, I've lectured on, and I've said it would be totally alien to what James Madison and those founders thought about. They had an education on democracy that we've seemed to have lost in political leadership these days, and it's only about the money. I'm going to be in less than a month now. I'm going to be lecturing to the state convention of Democratic women, the League of Democratic Women. And one of the things I'm going to be telling them is about the infrastructure that the right wing has built with all the money that they've had over the years. And all roads, I'm not sure they're going to say all roads lead to or all roads lead from, but it might be to and from basically the Koch brothers and their small coterie of other billionaires, the DeVosses and the like.
Don't forget Timothy Mellon.
And the Mellons, yeah. And that came out this week, Timothy Mellon, from the banking family out in Pittsburgh area, gave $50 million to the Trump campaign right after Trump was convicted. And he's also been the prime funder of the Bobby Kennedy campaign.
And he's the prime funder of Governor Abbott's anti-immigration movement right. down in Texas.
Right. Now, it's going to be, I want to see if he's going to dump any more money into Bobby Kennedy's. Kennedy's trying to get on the ballot in Pennsylvania. We'll see if he succeeds on that.
Kennedy didn't make the debate.
He didn't make the debate. And we've seen where a lot of the billionaires who were never Trumpers have started to come around again and are thinking about, if not actually giving Trump money for his campaign. But some of them have their reservations. We had that report a couple weeks ago. Andrew Ross Sorkin talked to the CEOs that Trump met with. About how good he was going to be for business. And a lot of them came out of there, or at least a significant number came out of there, shaking their heads. They were very skeptical about what Trump was saying, that he didn't make a lot of sense. He didn't have a lot of plans, that he was going to drop the corporate tax rate from 21% to 20%. And someone asked why, and he said, well, it's a round number. But it drives another hole in the deficit, and a big hole that you can't plug. But this idea of money, you mentioned Jeffrey Yaz, and I mentioned Art Pope. Yaz is trying to do this again. During the spring, he ran ads he launders his money through this Commonwealth Leadership Fund, and he ran ads around the state. We only saw two of them here against Jim Haddock, who covers parts of Lackawanna and Luzerne, and Eddie Pashinsky, my friend from down in Luzerne County. And lo and behold, Pashinsky didn't even have an opponent. The Republicans didn't put on the ballot, but the Republicans were able to get enough write-in votes to bring this guy, Dino Disler.
625.
Yeah, that's it. And now they're running ads for Disler, and they're running ads for Haddock's opponent. And also, they're running ads for the Republican candidate for state attorney general. And that's a very important race. We cannot overlook it. It's being overshadowed right now by the presidential race, by the senatorial race, and by the congressional races. But the attorney general matters in Pennsylvania. Used to be that Pennsylvania did not have an elected attorney general. We had an appointed attorney general by the governor. Then the Constitution changed, and for over 40 years, the only people who got elected were Republicans. Kathleen Kane from Lackawanna County broke that. Unfortunately, she was not a very competent administrator and a very competent politician, and actually wound up going to jail. But she was succeeded by Josh Shapiro, who was a competent politician. And it really mattered in the 2000 presidential race as to what positions the state would take on lawsuits that were being brought and who would defend the state. And it's not just in Pennsylvania. It's in all of the swing states or the purple states or the important states, the seven of them. Michigan is in that category, and they fought back and defeated a really radical Republican. So the Democrats are holds the attorney general there. The Democrat won the attorney generalship in Arizona under the same circumstances. The Republicans put up a radical. And in Pennsylvania, we're just going to have to see. There was a fairly strong contest among the Democrats. There were, I think, five different candidates. So they had a party split And Eugene De Pasquale, who's won state office before, won, but he has no prosecutorial experience. He's got administrative experience, but not prosecutorial experience. I think it's going to be a tough race against someone who has that. But Jeffrey Az is putting his money on that. And it's my humble opinion that the Democrats should be making hay over this plutocracy of this. They make Jeffrey Az. Why is a billionaire, the richest man in Pennsylvania, supporting these folks? What is he trying to buy? And the implication could also be brought to Dave McCormick, who's a billionaire trying to become the senator. Now, the polling on the senatorial race still has Bob Casey up on that. It's been pretty consistent, anywhere between 4 and 10 points. Right now, I think it's around a 6-point race, according to all the polls. But that could change. They keep pounding Casey on immigration and things, and we'll see what Casey's game plan is. It's going to be 100, it could be hundreds of millions of dollars. You mentioned the 8th district. Matt Cartwright has told me that each side is going to be putting $20 million into this race.
So each side is going to put $20 million?
Each side is going to put $20 million in. The Republican campaign committee has pledged $10 million of its own. So Cartwright's out, trying to raise his money, and the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee is backing him fully. They've got him near the top of their list, if not at the top, to protect. And lost in all of this, of course, is what, Matt Cartwright has brought to this area. He's in a powerful position. He's on the Appropriations Committee. When the Democrats were the majority in the House, he chaired the subcommittee on justice, commerce, and science, but justice being the big one. And, he told me personally that when the Justice Department came to him and said, we need money to prosecute the insurrectionist, and they gave him a figure, he gave them more money. He says, I don't want you guys to be shortchanged. I want you to go after these folks. And the House has a good chance of flipping back to the Democrats, and we'd love to see him there getting back in the Appropriations Committee and chairing one of the 12 subcommittees. And he's also been able to direct money for the train project to come through Monroe County. It's big for Monroe County in particular, but from New York City to reestablish service that was cut. So there's a lot at stake here on that race, but it's as I said, the millionaires and billionaires are going to be pouring money into all of these races.
Well, they are pouring money. That's exactly what they're doing. And in a situation like that, if you're an average working person, it's silly to think you could get involved in politics because you're not going to be able to raise the millions of dollars necessary.
Yeah. What the Republicans have wanted and what they have against Matt Cartwright is a guy who can help fund himself. Rob Bresnahan is a fairly wealthy young man, and he's put money into his race. Matt's opponent, a number of years ago, the guy from New Jersey, was a multimillionaire and put money into his race. That's what they're kind of looking at. But that's the effect, as you said, of Citizens United.
Yeah.
The pernicious effect of Citizens United.
Well, could there be anything but a pernicious effect?
No.
The whole intent was perniciousness.
Yes. Yes. And we shouldn't forget also, it's not just on legislative races. Don't forget our friend Clarence Thomas. Someone said that the robes of the justices ought to have, these little stickers like NASCAR as to which billionaire or multimillionaire owns them. We've got Harlan Crow. And within, as we mentioned, within the last couple weeks, how many of those, you know, how much money Crow has given to Thomas, and how much, and other perks that have been bestowed upon him. When you look at the amounts that are reported, I mean, Thomas is like more than all the other justices put together by a factor of maybe 5 or 10. And he continues to sit on that court and do damage, refuses to recuse himself. This week we had, although he's become somewhat a little bit more isolated on the court, they're, you know, he and Alito are finding themselves on the short end of 7-2 decisions. This week he found himself on the short end of an 8-1 decision. But the reason he dissented on that case about domestic violence, whether people who are guilty of domestic violence should be allowed to own firearms, didn't go to the firearm issue as much as it went to the analytics that he's employing, where he says that there's no historical precedent to prohibit people from owning, who are domestic abusers, from owning guns. And, of course, this argument is a loaded argument. It's an unbalanced argument because it's the same one when he says, and it's one of the ones that Alito used in the Dobbs decision, where you looked at what the history was back in the colonial times or in the post-Civil War times, and you know where women weren't allowed to vote or hold positions or have their voices heard. Minorities weren't allowed to have their voices heard. So it was already a stacked deck. So you're saying, oh, look, you know, it's sort of like saying, well, only slaveholders' views on human rights can be considered.
Well, I think that that's completely in order, because that goes exactly with what he is arguing should be the standard of judgment, history and tradition. After all, in pre-colonial and in colonial times, slave owners were almost uniform, male slave owners were almost uniformly rapists and abusers within the household. They beat women as a regular thing, and they all owned guns.
Sure.
So the historical tradition of the United States is that abusers and rapists should be allowed to own guns.
Right. I mean, the great fear was that blacks should become armed.
Yeah.
I mean, wasn't the John Brown raid on a federal armory arsenal?
That's exactly right. It was to get guns to arm the slaves surrounding Harper's Ferry for a slave uprising. Exactly right. Exactly right. And when money was raised for John Brown and his forces by the leading intellectuals of New England, the money was raised in order to buy guns, Sharp's rifles.
Well,
yep. But John Brown was not an abuser.
No. No. He was on a fool's errand.
Well, but I don't know how foolish it was. He led the resistance in Kansas, turned it into a free state, and people did go. It's true he was hung, but troops went marching into battle in the Civil War singing John Brown's body.
Yeah, he became an.
Was the leading martyr of the Union cause.
Yeah, he became the martyr of the cause.
Yeah.
But the he and his family lost their lives there. He wasn't going to win that battle. Let me put it that way.
No, he wasn't going to win that battle. He wasn't.
And wasn't that Stonewall Jackson that with the students from VMI that helped put that rebellion down?
I think it was Robert E. Lee.
Maybe it was Robert E. Lee.
I think it was Robert E. Lee. Yep.
Well, whatever. And of course, now you get these school districts that now want to restore Robert E. Lee's name,
right.
Stonewall Jackson's name to schools.
That's right.
You know, and
but
course,
now you're getting into the role of ideas. Yeah. Now you're getting into the role of studying history. And that brings us to Florida, where Governor DeSantis this week vetoed the entire budget for next year for cultural institutions in Florida. Did you see that?
Yeah, I saw that. And that
not even a dollar, not even a token, zero.
And that caught even his supporters, and a lot of Republicans caught them by surprise, because you know, a lot of, well, that's how they some of these rich Republicans try to gain respect, by supporting the arts and cultural institutions.
Well, at the most crass level, art tourism is a big thing. People want to go to places where there are concerts, where there are art exhibits, where there are, you know, lectures. People want that. That's part of life.
We'll see.
Apparently, not down there.
We'll see how that reflects. Whether it becomes a campaign issue this year in the Rick Scott race, or whether it has a more lasting effect. You know, the longer
he said he cut it, he vetoed it for the good of Florida.
Yeah. Well, he says a lot of things that don't make sense. But they we'll see if, you know, the overall effect of the radicalization of DeSantis's policies starts peeling off support for Republicans over time. I'm not overly optimistic in the short term, but we'll have to see. There's something else, though, I wanted to talk about in terms of money. And as you know, I've talked about for years and years this infrastructure that was built up after the Lewis Powell memo, that ideas matter. And one of the places where this has been built up is the Heritage Foundation. And I think we're going to have to, in the coming weeks, spend more and more time on that. There, this weekend, I saw the head of the Heritage Foundation, a guy named Kevin Roberts, on MSNBC. And, I mean, talk about a really, really, I don't know what you call him, radical or reactionary, but a real true believer type of guy who asserts...
I call him a fascist.
That might be a fitting description. He asserts with such, you know, Trumpian assurance that the 2020 election was fraudulent. He asserts that abortion is not health care, it's only murder, even when women are in danger of dying with sepsis. Things like that. And they've been funded to the hilt to try to put together a package and a program, a portfolio as to what the second Trump term would be like in order to take over the government. And firing wholesale people in administrative positions, are doing away with whole parts of the federal government, and inserting party loyalists, Trump loyalists, and maintaining power in solely from the executive.
I think that you shouldn't make people think that this is just sort of a ad hoc approach. They've been working at it for 2 years. They've enlisted over 100 different right-wing think tanks to cooperate with them. They have issued a 945-page document called Project 2025, which chapter by chapter goes through every single agency of the federal government to describe a plan for restructuring it and changing it. They have vetted 10,000 candidates for appointment to federal office. The president has the right to appoint about 4,000 people. That's the number of political appointees. They've built up a database of 10,000 Trumpists who they, you know, feel are got the right politics to implement this program. And they've identified all the leaders that are going to, you know, on day one, that can step into office. They've typed up the executive orders that are required. It requires only his signature at the right moment, if he gets a chance to make his signature. this is something that has never been seen before in the United States.
Well, and this is because right after Kevin Roberts, they the hosts, Michael Steele and Simone Saunders, had my favorite, Ruth Ben-Ghiat, on to kind of explain it. They didn't give her enough time. I think that they ran short of time. But she called it for what it was. You know, this is Bannonism. This is Steve Bannon's idea to deconstruct the administrative state so they, excuse me, so they could get rid of the checks and balances, the constraints on the grifters.
Yeah, they don't think that they want to get rid of the state. They want the state. These people are statists. Fascists are statists. They just don't want the state that currently exists. They want to change the nature of the state.
Yeah. And that's what Donald Trump wants to do.
Yeah, but here they have a problem with the Koch brothers. Of course, the Koch brothers are libertarians. They want to get rid of the state. So they have to make some compromises. So they will be willing to get rid of the Department of Education. That they all agree on. They'll get rid of that. But where it matters, where, you know...
Well, it'll matter in places like the Department of Justice.
Yeah.
Where they wanted to put in Clark...
well, they want to be in a position to identify who disagrees with them, arrest them, and keep them in jail.
Yeah.
And that part of the state that's required to do that, that's what they want to keep.
The administrative detention type of thing.
Yeah. You don't have to get charged with anything. Just sit in jail.
Right. You know, just as an aside, you know, we talked about Jeffrey Clark. His name came up through Scott Perry. Remember, Scott Perry was one of the people who wanted to get a pardon from Donald Trump before Trump left.
And Mike Johnson just appointed him to the Intelligence Committee of the Congress.
Over objections to a lot of people in the Congress, but it's what Donald Trump wanted.
Right.
But the interesting thing is Scott Perry is now in a neck-and-neck race. The Democrats managed to nominate a woman who is well-known in that area. She was a television reporter, a commentator. For a long time, and there's going to be a lot of money put in that race as well. Of course, it won't matter if Perry gets defeated and Trump wins, because he'll just be appointed to some important post,
right?
Which is why these things really...
But it still matters if he could get defeated. It would be good to defeat him.
Oh, yes. Yeah, I mean, we saw... Talk about defeat, we're waiting to see what happens in Virginia with Bob Good, who's really misnamed. You called his opponent. It wasn't a race with good and an opponent. It was a race between bad and worse.
Right. Exactly.
That was
just for our listeners. Bob Good is the chairman of the so-called Freedom Caucus. The Marjorie Taylor Greene Group Caucus.
Yeah.
And Matt Gaetz.
And he's rankled a lot of people. But
Well, listen. Let's next week talk some more about Project 2025.
Yeah.
I mean, it's true we'll have the debate to talk about. That's taking place Thursday.
Right.
But let's dig a little bit into Project 2025.
Yes. A lot of people don't know what it is, and it's more important. The more they realize what it is, I think the more they'll understand the importance of the choice in the presidential election, and where you can't allow the good to the perfect to be the enemy of the good.
All right. Then with that, we wind up. We're done.
We're done.
We'll see you next week.
You've been listening to Forward with Falk. Longtime Scranton political observer Dave Falk and WFTE's Jake Rosen discuss politics. Join them again next week. Same time, same place.